Thank you, Henry, for that kind introduction, and thanks to Cardozo for the invitation. It's always good to be back in New York, where it's not nearly as damp as it is in Oxford, although it's also a little bit warmer. So if I sniffle through this a little bit because I have allergies about a month earlier than I should be having, I apologize in advance. In my remarks tonight, I'm going to discuss the relationship between two independently perhaps important topics, that is international copyright law and the Google Book Settlement. At first blush, this seems perhaps too ambitious a task, I think, for a 40-45 minute lecture. The Google Books amended settlement agreement is an immensely complex document. That's the bulk of paper sitting in front of me, which many of you may have read, and some of you in here I know in immense detail. In fact, when I was trying to get a handle on the nature of that settlement, my first reaction was that I was reading, and this is a reaction that those who are critics of the class action device, it might resonate with. My first reaction was that I was reading a copyright statute of the nation of Bhutania or something like that. So as a result, I'm going to avoid really any in-depth analysis of the nuts and bolts of the agreement. There's other people here probably that are doing that. But focusing on the relationship between the settlement and international copyright law might not seem the most obvious move to simplify the topic. After all, as the late Barbara Ringer said now 50 years ago, if copyright is the metaphysics of the law, international copyright is its cosmology. But viewing the settlement through an international lens is surely important, because Google's stated corporate goal is to organize the world's information, not just that of the United States. And despite a narrowing of the scope of the books that are covered by this amended settlement from those covered by the original settlement agreement, several foreign governments and foreign publishers continue to express concern that the amended agreement will irretrievably shape the nature of copyright in books on a worldwide basis. So despite the caution that I think Barbara Ringer's words should perhaps inspire, I'm going to look at the settlement from an international copyright angle. Actually, there are two angles from which we might explore the relationship between international copyright law on the one hand and the settlement on the other. So the first one is when we look at the question of what international copyright law has to say about the Google Book Settlement. That seems obvious, but you could also invert that question, I think, and ask what the Google Book Settlement has to say about international copyright law. In talking about international copyright law, essentially answering that first question, I'm proceeding on a conventional understanding of what international copyright law is, essentially public international law, a set of rules concluded among nation states that set a minimum level of protection internationally with very few maximums, ensuring equal protection for foreigners while retaining latitude for countries to tailor national laws to different national priorities and to reconcile different copyright traditions, all with an eye to the creation, the protection, and distribution of original works on a worldwide basis. So that's basically the whole international corporate law caricature. But more concretely, it is essentially the Berne Convention, the TRIPS Agreement, and the White Book Copyright Treaty. But remarkably, given that the settlement may be, one could have a debate about other developments, but it may be the most important development in access to literature that the world has seen for many decades, the majority of scholars take the view that international copyright instruments have almost nothing to say about the settlement. And I'm going to suggest that perhaps international copyright law should have more to say about the settlement than is conventionally thought. But if that prevailing wisdom is correct, if in fact international copyright law is of only very little relevance to this hugely important development, then perhaps it actually says an awful lot about international copyright law. Perhaps it might tell us something about what we need to do to ensure a legal environment that enables the construction of a truly modern Library of Alexandria, one that recognizes the capacity to fulfill the most ambitious dreams of a digital era and offer global access to the knowledge of the world. It may be that the public international law of copyright needs urgently to be updated to address this type of issue. And without excluding that possibility, however, I want to look at one other aspect of how we construct that environment for internationally minded projects, such as I think the Google Back Settlement is, by concluding my remarks by briefly looking also at how private international law might regard the settlement. So let's start then. Why then, or what then, does international copyright law have to say about the Google Book Settlement? Well, I said I was going to try and avoid the nuts and bolts, but it's important just to identify a couple of aspects so we're all on the same page of the amended settlement that are important to this discussion. So there's really three parts of the settlement I want to just briefly highlight. First of all, the international reach, geographic reach of the settlement. Secondly, the treatment of foreign right holders vis-a-vis domestic right holders. And thirdly, the extent to which any of the rights that are involved, whether you think of them as benefits or disadvantages, to what extent they are dependent upon filings that have to be made in particular places. So let's start with the international reach of the settlement. There are really two separate components to the question of the geographic or international reach. There's the question of which books are subject to the settlement, and then there's the separate question of which rights are subject to the settlement. So let's start with the books that are covered. The original settlement purported to cover pretty much every book published anywhere in the world. That's overstating it by much. Foreign right holders in particular protested the breadth of that original settlement, and therefore the amended settlement agreement narrowed the scope of books that are covered to include books registered with the U.S. Copyright Office or those that have a place of publication in the United Kingdom, Canada, or Australia. Those countries were chosen because of the supposedly common legal heritage, though, as I was saying to Mike and Henry before, after returning after 2 decades, I'm beginning to question the commonality of the legal heritage, the more I had to relearn British law after 20 years. But that was in theory behind the choice of the UK, Canada, Australia as the additional countries. Now, that revision clearly narrows, actually in numerical terms, quite substantially narrows the corpus of books that are subject to the settlement. But it doesn't narrow the scope of books covered to American, Canadian, British, and American works, as you might think. Many foreign works are registered, have been registered with the U.S. Copyright Office, for example. And those works, including by many foreign authors from countries that are members of the Berne Convention, will be therefore subject to the settlement. And that's potentially important because international copyright law speaks much more intrusively to the treatment of foreign authors under national law than domestic authors. A fact that is reflected in a couple of provisions of the U.S. Copyright Act will give preferential treatment to foreign authors, to works at least of a non-U.S. origin. The second component of the question of geographic reach is which rights are subject to the settlement. Well, by virtue of the principle of territoriality, paradoxically, but for very good reasons enshrined in international copyright law, an original literary work embodied in a book automatically is imbued with somewhere around 180 national copyrights. Thus, a British book, upon fixation, is immediately covered by a U.S. copyright, a French copyright, an Australian copyright, and so on. And the settlement, both in original and amended form, importantly, despite the fact that there are 180 bits of this property intangible attaching to the book, purports only to affect U.S. rights. Thus, while a British book might be covered by the settlement, it's only the U.S. rights in that British book that actually are compromised by the parties in the agreement. The British copyright remains in theory untouched, and the right holder can sue Google in the United Kingdom based on its UK copyright if Google engages in conduct in the UK that is infringement under the Copyright Designs and Patents Act 1988. Now, what conduct infringes each pertinent national right is a matter of national law, subject to the international instruments. But a starting assumption is that conduct in country A is relevant to potential infringement of copyright in country A, and conduct in country B is relevant to potential infringement of copyright in country B. The settlement largely works on this territorial assumption, and internet users abroad will not have works made available to them in the form contemplated by the U.S. settlement. They might still have works made available to them through Google projects, but not according to the terms of the U.S. settlement. Now, of course, the internet has made it harder to sustain those territorial lines. And actually, interesting, the French government makes note in its objections to the court in the Rule 23 proceedings of the fact that a foreign internet user could get access to the Google Book Corpus through relatively unremarkable technological sleight of hand. One doesn't really need to be sort of a security hacker to be able to get access. As a result, they say, some of the conduct that's authorized by the settlement, in theory only vis-a-vis American rights, may in fact have effects abroad. But that's not a problem, it's important to note, that's unique to the Google Book Project. And to the extent that effects abroad implicate foreign rights that are infringed under applicable law, the foreign right holders will be able to sue in those countries for violations of those foreign rights, and indeed that's already happened in a couple of lawsuits in France. And this too is very important, because the extent to which the settlement impinges upon the cultural autonomy and lawmaking autonomy of other countries as alleged by the foreign governments of France and Germany, in particular in Bruce Fowle in court, is surely affected, though maybe not completely resolved, by whether it purports to make determinations of permissible conduct under the laws of those other countries. So that's the sort of geographic or territorial aspects of the settlement. The second point I want just to raise by way of introduction is the treatment of foreign right holders vis-a-vis treatment of domestic right holders. This is important because one of the longest standing commitments of international copyright law has been non-discrimination against foreign authors in the principle of national treatment, and to some extent now among foreign authors under the MFN provision of the TRIPS Agreement Article 4. But the agreement doesn't on its face impose any additional requirement on right holders who are nationals of foreign countries. Despite the protestations from certain foreign governments and publishers about the extension of the settlement to foreign right holders, I would argue, in fact, excluding such right holders from the settlement based simply on nationality might, in fact, have caused very different problems of Berne compliance and might have outraged a completely separate set of foreign authors and publishers who support the settlement, perhaps showing the tightrope that the parties are having to try and walk. So that's the second introductory point by way of factual background. The third one is that some of the analysis of compliance of the settlement with international law is going to depend upon the formalities that the settlement imposes on right holders. And let's just briefly mention the formalities, the extent to which there's filing required of right holders to take advantage of the benefits or opt out of the settlement. So the most obvious filing requirement that this mechanism might be said to impose, and this now has to be in the past tense, was the filing that would be required if I, as a class member, wish to opt out of the settlement as permitted by Rule 23 of the Federal Rules. That is, if I, as a UK author, wish to preserve the exclusive rights that are conferred by me by the US Copyright Act, as required by international law, I am required to opt out. Of course, I may still have rights under the settlement, even if I don't opt out, but those rights fall short of the exclusive rights that otherwise would be the default under the statute and the treaty. So there's an opt-out filing involved, implicated by Rule 23. Moreover, even if I have not opted out of the class, if I allow myself to continue as part of the class, and thus my works are subject to the settlement, if I wish to receive all the benefits of the agreement, including payments of monies, I'm required to file claim forms with the books registry that will be created by the agreement. So one way or the other, whether I want the rights conferred by copyright law as the default by opting out, or the rights conferred by the settlement, I may be obliged to make a filing of some sort, possibly. All right, so there's the background of the sort of main aspects, and of course there are 400 pages or 380 pages or something in the settlement, so that's a little bit of a summary, but these are the main points that are relevant to my analysis. So let me turn to the first question that I posed. What does international copyright law have to say about the settlement? The international copyright law is invoked by a large number of the foreign objectors to the settlement in particular, and I'm going to frame my discussion largely by reference to those objections, in particular those submitted by the French and German governments. But I want to step back before I do that and identify three different sets of issues that one can find in both the scholarly debate and indeed to some extent in the briefs that are submitted. So the first question, it's a sort of subpart here, is does the settlement agreement violate international copyright law? Or stated another way, would approval of the settlement expose the United States to a complaint filed against it in the WTO, at least in the case of a Berne Convention or a TRIPS violation? That's the first question. Second question, assuming that the settlement agreement is in violation of international copyright law, does that per se preclude Judge Chitten from approving the settlement? Now, without giving away my answer to the first question, I should tell you that my second question will be a very short discussion, regardless of the answer to my first question, which will tell you where I'm going to go with the discussion. Third, even if international copyright law doesn't preclude Judge Chitten from approving the settlement, should it still be relevant in some less binding way to his decision whether to approve the settlement? And so three separate, slightly different questions. Professor Sam Ricketson, who is probably the leading authority on the Berne Convention, concludes that the settlement agreement does not violate international copyright law. I'm not going to address all of his possible arguments in detail. In fact, you can find them in a memo that James Scrumholm's website conveniently has linked to. I should acknowledge James' efforts. I have to say, whatever understanding I have of the settlement is entirely due to James' website created by his students and his colleagues. It is a tremendous resource, which they would all be thankful that I was trying to work in this area. But Professor Ricketson concludes that it is not a violation of international corporate law. I'm not going to go into all of them in detail, but I want to focus in particular on the main argument that you might basically call his trump card. And that is that this is a private settlement agreement that does not even implicate or engage with international corporate law. And that's an argument that you find echoed in a number of the commentators who basically say we shouldn't be worried about the international aspects. That argument, that you call the trump card argument, really takes two forms, one of which is, I think, more persuasive than the other. You'll see I'll take issue with both of them. They perhaps can be dealt with together because they both go to the juridical character of a settlement of a class action lawsuit when approved by a court. The first form of the argument is that this is a court decision, and single court decisions are not subject to WTO review. The second form of the argument, and here I quote from Professor Ricketson, is that the settlement is, quote, not a settlement that has been directed by government or Congress, but is a private settlement between the parties, albeit one that has been enabled by the particular procedural provisions of U.S. law with respect to class actions. In short, that's the end of the quote, in short, taken together, these arguments stress that international copyright law imposes obligations on countries, not on individuals litigating particular private disputes. Interestingly, that line of reasoning engages with a broader domestic argument made by a number of objectors, that the settlement essentially functions as a piece of legislation enacted without the involvement of Congress. Sometimes, again, paralleling Professor Ricketson, the domestic argument is made in absolute terms, that this is simply the type of thing that is a matter for Congress, and that the courts should not be engaged in a class action determination of it. I find that argument unpersuasive in its absolute form, but the softer form of the domestic argument, which the government and others have raised, I think is more persuasive. And that is that any impropriety here is probably the result of the relief contained in the settlement. That is to say, the settlement addresses the wholesale copying of books rather than the snippets that formed the basis of the initial complaint that was filed against Google. Well, how does that form of the settlement as a judicially sanctioned compromise of a single private dispute affect the international law analysis? Does it, as Professor Ricketson would say, immunize the settlement essentially from scrutiny? Well, let me suggest the line should not be as bright as Professor Ricketson suggests. It seems to me there's a spectrum of actions that should be more or less susceptible to scrutiny under international law. I have no doubt that a single copyright lawsuit settled by two parties in ways that compromise their respective claims does and should not engage with the international obligations of the United States. Likewise, I have no doubt that a single private contract between two parties is equally untouched by Berne or by TRIPS. International law, in a benthamite sense, is about obligations between nation states. International copyright law, given the definition I gave you of public international law, is really no exception. However, I do have rather serious doubts that the mere fact of the abrogation of internationally guaranteed rights, if that is what is achieved by the settlement, which I'll get to, is not clear. If, in fact, that is what's going on, the mere fact that it is abrogated by judicial rather than legislative or executive decision should not absolve the United States. Of course, Professor Ricketson is correct. A WTO panel is not an appeal tribunal hearing an appeal from national courts. However, it is clearly the case that a WTO panel will, in determining whether a member state's law is in compliance with international obligations, have regard to the interpretation of that law by the courts of a particular member state. So, for example, in the 110.5 panel report, the WTO panel looked to the decisions, and actually not very many decisions at that, of U.S. courts to determine the meaning of the homestyle and business exemptions in 110.5. Likewise, in the recent report challenging the enforcement by China of its copyright law, the United States relied quite heavily on the pattern of decisions by the Chinese courts. Professor Ricketson suggests that these types of arguments, based upon patterns of judicial decision, which is really what the U.S. was arguing in the China case, and I quote, hardly seems applicable to the instance of a single case, as here, where the real complaint is what about what the parties themselves have agreed to, unquote. But this brings us back to the domestic arguments about what is the real character of the settlement. Is it really, and I quote Professor Ferguson, a single case where the real complaint is about what the parties themselves have agreed to? Well, in answering that question, it's worth acknowledging first that, unlike in Section 110.5, the judicial decisions that are being considered would come in the form of the approval of this settlement, and that would, on its face, establish the meaning of any aspect of American copyright law. So whether displaying snippets of a work or making an entire intermediate copy of the work for that purpose is fair use, for example, which is probably the most interesting substantive question that the complaint raised, would formally remain unresolved under U.S. law. The court's decision wouldn't actually say anything about that. However, it is surely inappropriate to disregard the real nature of a class action settlement. This is not a single case. Indeed, as an initial matter, just as a complete formal matter, it's two cases consolidated. And more fundamentally, the central settlement will compromise millions of claims. If individual claimants had serially brought infringement claims against Google and each was settled according to the same pattern, would that same result be equally immune from WTO scrutiny? And as we now know from the photographers and illustrators lawsuit filed last week, even with the consolidation of all the book claims in the first class action, this practice of serial litigation of disputes with Google about the book project may in fact be in the offing. So I have great doubts about this being immune from scrutiny simply because we call it a private settlement. As for, and I quote, what the parties themselves have agreed to, unquote, courts are very actively involved in certifying the class and approving the settlement of class actions. The settlement is not, as would be the case in a standard settlement of a private litigation that Professor Richardson hypothesizes, simply filing an order embodying the private agreement of the parties and agreeing to dismiss the case. In fact, the parties have already withdrawn what they themselves agreed. The final agreement will embody their agreement only within the boundaries of what the court thinks appropriate as a matter of law. And all of this can be said about the settlement not being really a single case where the real complaint is about what the parties themselves agreed to, I think, without even getting into the issues of market dominance that might underlie and support that contention. Now, by saying all of this, I don't mean to suggest that the U.S. Class action device is a violation of international law. It's clearly open to the United States as a matter of international law to resolve private disputes in the manner it sees fit. And in fact, you can find analogs to class action devices in a number of common law countries. All international copyright instruments give countries quite large latitude as to the means by which to implement their obligations. And that latitude is especially wide in the context of enforcement mechanisms. But there should be a flip side to allowing member states to implement their obligations in ways consistent with their own legal tradition. That is, one cannot simply avoid those obligations by using the device of a class action if what it actually does is the equivalent of enacting a statute. Of course, the court might well prune back the settlement if it buys some of the arguments or the objections, particularly the DOJ. That makes it seem much more in the nature back of that private settlement agreement between two parties contemplated and hypothesized by Professor Richardson, making it, I would suggest, then maybe less susceptible to international review. Moreover, taking the more interventionist approach that I suggest is appropriate would not of itself determine the question of compliance with international law. It would simply make the international law standards relevant. So perhaps those arguing for compatibility with international copyright law are at the end of the day still correct. However, I don't think one should be able to reach that conclusion simply by asserting that this is a private agreement between two parties to resolve a single dispute. As I said, even if you buy my more interventionist approach, one has to find a violation of international law. So let me briefly mention a couple of the arguments that might come up if the nature of the settlement agreement doesn't ipso facto confer immunity from scrutiny from international law. Both France and Germany have characterized the settlement as the creation of a de facto compulsory license in violation, among other things, of Article 9 of the Berne Convention. Likewise, it is argued that the different filings that are required of foreign right holders to protect or enforce rights granted by the Berne Convention, so either having to opt out of the settlement to keep your exclusive rights that you're granted under Article 9, or taking advantage of the benefits, quote-unquote, of the settlement, either of those constitute formalities that violate Article 5.2 of the Berne Convention. So let me comment briefly on that argument. Article 5.2 provides that, I quote, the enjoyment and the exercise of the rights guaranteed by the Convention shall not be subject to any formality, unquote. Well, one preliminary point must be made about that provision. Textually, it appears to countenance no formality being imposed on the enforcement of copyright. But this is somewhat akin to the First Amendment declaring that Congress shall enact no law that abridges freedom of speech. Matters really aren't quite so absolute. After all, if I wish to sue to enforce my copyright, even in a domestic case, I do actually have to file a complaint with the court. So with that in mind, are these filings the type of formalities that are violative of Verne? Well, they're clearly not of the nature of the formalities that we're used to in the United States that kept us out of the Berne Convention for over a century. Failure to make these filings will not cause the loss of copyright in the books in question, won't prevent the owner suing other potential defendants for infringement of copyright. But the provisions of the Berne Convention and the scope of Article 5.2 are in fact broader and strike at formalities that impose penalties that are short of the loss of copyright, as is known, I think, too well, perhaps, in the United States. Despite that, leading scholars, almost without exception of international copyright law, appear to agree that the filing necessary to opt out of the settlement does not constitute a violation of Article 5.2. Professor Richardson expressly takes this position on a number of grounds. First, he argues that basically this is a procedural formality. I'm not persuaded by that characterization. It strikes me that almost every formality, other than the loss of copyright, is in fact procedural, and almost by definition is contrary to being substantive. But there are other reasons that I think he advances that support that contention. And likewise, Professor Daniel Gervais, who's a leading authority on the TRIPS Agreement, has offered arguments in the context of opt-out filings required under extended collective licensing schemes, such as you find in some of the Nordic countries, that appears to support Professor Richardson's argument. And I think they're right in the sense that if you look at the historical analysis of the development of the Berne Convention, the prohibition on formalities was not intended to undermine generally applicable rules of procedure, such as those found in Rule 23. It's not an attempt to target copyright Rule 23 as a series of requirements that apply in any litigation that's a class action. Nor would the scope of the prohibition meant to address filings were efforts to identify authors and thus facilitate the receipt of benefits, which in theory is consistent with the purpose of the convention, which is to reward authorship. So I think the formalities case actually might be hard. The Article 9 case we can perhaps get into in questions of others, people afterwards, so I don't want to take too long. But let me just raise one other argument that may be much more speculative, but I think suggests a couple of ironies here. And it's not made as explicitly by the foreign governments, but it's intriguing. And that is that in the context of their objections to the certification and approval of the settlement, the foreign right holders in particular suggest that they will be operating at a disadvantage relative to other right holders. Now, to an international copyright lawyer, as soon as you hear disadvantage relative to other right holders that are American, the trigger that goes off in your head is, well, there's going to be a national treatment or most favored nation issue here. And it's important that there is a national treatment obligation in both Berne and TRIPS, and that although there's nothing on the face of the agreement that simply makes a differentiation based upon nationality, both the WTO panel in the European Union Geographical Indications case and the appellate body in the US Section 211, that's the Havana Club case, were willing to go behind the formal equal treatment to see if there was discrimination in effect. So the 211 appellate body decision and the GI case both say they're looking at whether there is an, quote, effective equality of opportunity, unquote. Likewise, by analogy, though it's dealing with a different substantive provision of the patent parts of the agreement, the Canada Patents panel, interpreting Article 27, appear to be willing to look at realities than more than just simply form. So I think the fact that there's nothing on its face doesn't preclude the possibility of that type of complaint. And foreign publishers have argued that the restriction of the settlement to books which have a place of publication in the UK, Canada, or Australia still effectively treats right holders from other countries less favorably than US right holders, or right holders from at least from those three countries. Right holders from countries other than the US, the UK, Canada, Australia are less likely in practice, on effect, to come within the settlement, even though, as we suggested at the beginning, it was possible. Now, of course, it's a strange irony in this argument, which also may affect the way you would have to advance an MFN case, and that is that being within the scope of the settlement more favorable than being outside the scope of the settlement. And so being outside the settlement is a benefit, as the foreign right holders argue for the purposes of the Article 9 argument, that is to say their exclusive rights are being diluted by the settlement, then the contraction of the scope of the amended settlement would appear in fact in favor the right holders rather than disadvantaged. If instead being within the settlement is a benefit, you might actually get paid, someone might actually read your work, then the contraction in scope might make the claim of a national treatment violation easier to see. The briefs of the foreign right holders and the governments do identify some disparate treatment that might appear to exist even if being outside of the settlement is a benefit. But it's not clear that that's of the type that's previously been considered a problem under the national treatment of most favored nations. So the principal disadvantage that their papers suggest is the costs of working out whether in fact you're part of the class or not. And that seems an argument that goes more to me to the commonality of the claims and the fairness of the settlement, which are, to be very fair to the governments, the context in which they advance those arguments, and compliance with international law. So at the end of the day, what I would say is it is still probably open to some doubt, as indeed Professor Richardson concludes, whether each of the arguments would be upheld if advanced before a panel of the WTO's dispute settlement body. But I would rather reach that conclusion, if I had to, after subjecting the settlement to some degree of scrutiny under international law. All right, second question, which I said I'd answer quickly, so I promise I will, and that is, even if I were right that the nature of the settlement agreement shouldn't of itself immunize the United States from a potential breach of international corporate law, and even if a panel would find that the terms of the settlement did violate Burma TRIPS, which as we saw is just perfectly clear, would that preclude Judge Chin from approving the settlement? And that is the only answer I have any confidence in giving this evening, and that is no. Which is to say the Berne Convention is not self-executing, and neither is the TRIPS agreement. So that's the easy answer. That's the one that the student gets who gets the C- and just passes. You get that one, that's the question. And a third question, which I think is actually more interesting, does that make it irrelevant to Judge Chin? I think the answer to this is also no, maybe not quite so easy. I'm not going to develop this point in huge details. I think this largely turns on principles of Rule 23, which I'm not entirely familiar. But the objections filed by both the French and the German governments do make the argument that the settlement is inconsistent with international copyright law, but they also make much subtler arguments that say we'd like you essentially to take into account what you might call international copyright concerns. I call these the Eldred concerns, which is that international law doesn't require you to do it, but it would be a good thing. In terms of the overall international claim. So, for example, the German government viewed the settlement as setting a dangerous precedent and one that would, I quote, obviate equitable, fair, and comprehensive solutions through the more appropriate channels of international treaties and cooperation or legislation, unquote. Now, putting aside that rather naive view of the treaty-making process, at least in contemporary terms, the complaint is, I think, in large part about the process of making international copyright law. And in this context, the language of the Supreme Court and the Amchem Court, which is the asbestosis class action case from a decade ago, I think resonates with some analogy. That is to say, the scheme that is in the settlement may be a very sensible solution in moving towards a global treatment of orphan works, for example. But it is not clear that the class action is, in fact, the fairest and appropriate vehicle for achieving that sensible solution. In contrast, the fact that the settlement, much to the French government's chagrin, apparently does not care much about compliance with French law, shouldn't be surprising and perhaps is not likely to be given much weight. The French government's complaint that the settlement threatens cultural diversity and demeans, I quote, those special elements that distinguish the unique cultural traditions of France by turning books into a mere industrial byproduct of a computer database, unquote, seems rather beside the point if we're talking about American law. This isn't a bug. National autonomy is a feature of international copyright law. If Germany believes that exclusivity remains an important principle to uphold, it should do so. That's what international regulatory competition is about. Of course, it may be, however, that we need to reallocate the balance between national autonomy and global standards given the growing interdependence of digital markets. But present understandings of international copyright law accept these differences that are raised by the governments as the price for sovereignty. All right. That's really the part about what international law has to say about the Google Book settlement. Let me conclude just for a few minutes, and I'll be very brief, about what the Google Book settlement says about international copyright law. As I said at the beginning, international copyright law is really being conventionally conceived of as a set of obligations between nation states designed to ensure certain minimum levels of protection on a worldwide basis and facilitate creation and distribution internationally. But if, in fact, Professor Ricketson is right, that system apparently has almost nothing to say about the settlement. If private ordering, and that's, again, let's give that characterization as a take as a given, is used increasingly to set the levels of protection available to authors, are there any international principles that will regulate the extension of this model on a worldwide basis? If Google wishes efficiently to establish a global business model that allows it to organize, and I quote, all the world's information, does it have to strike similar deals on a worldwide basis? Indeed, given the fact that the existing settlement in the U.S. affects foreign right holders, will this deal even be enforced internationally? Now, those questions are in large part dependent upon private international law of copyright. Treaties on the private international copyright law are close to non-existent. In fact, absolutely, a complete treaty is non-existent, and even provisions within treaties are close to are non-existent. And the ALI principles on the topic, which might over time cause some convergence, were adopted only 3 years ago. Rather, the body of principles that we're dealing with here are primarily national law, and even there you will find that if you look at the main decisions under U.S. national law, they've all been within the last 12 years. So you can go back to Boosie and Hawkes on subject matter jurisdiction, you can go back to Eisner, Tass and Choice of Law, you can go back to Faroe, all these Second Circuit decisions just 5 years ago. We're dealing with a pretty nascent and relatively inchoate body of law. So what I thought I would explore here to work out whether, in fact, private international law would affect the ability of this to be regarded as an internationalizing settlement is whether or not the Google Book settlement would be enforced abroad. And more particularly, would it be enforced against absent class members? Well, since the United Kingdom has been officially declared a place of common legal heritage, I thought I would ask the question from the perspective of a UK court faced with recognizing a judgment against a British right holder. Well, given that the UK recognizes something that's pretty close to class actions, it's unlikely that the mere nature of the class action device would preclude recognition on some public policy ground. Despite that, and although scholarly opinion is divided without any, I think, definitive judicial decision, the prevailing view among English conflict scholars is that an English court would be unlikely to confer a preclusive effect on a judgment or court-approved settlement against an English party who did not opt out of the class. Before an English court will recognize or enforce a judgment, the court must have been jurisdictionally competent according to the rules of English law. And English law would not regard being a member of a class as either submission to jurisdiction or being in privity with a class representative. Now, of course, the US court certifying the class will have made some determination of the commonality of interest, but the UK courts have thus far insisted on ignoring the foreign determinations and applying English jurisdiction rules, saying that if you want us to start looking at what the other court thought about jurisdiction, we'll need a convention. Quite explicitly, they've said that. Now, those views have been largely formed in the context of securities litigations, not copyright cases, in many cases not class action cases. But a recent copyright decision, which I should declare I think is absolutely abominable, but this is the authoritative decision at the moment, the English Court of Appeal, I think, does nothing to suggest being any less cautious. The case is a case called Lucasfilms versus Ainsworth, which was handed down 4 months ago in the UK. This is a case involving the copyright in the design of the Stormtrooper's helmets from Star Wars. Lucasfilms sued the English defendant in courts in California and got a default judgment of $20 million, which was quite a judgment for sales of $14,000 into the United States. The Court of Appeal in England refused to enforce that judgment 4 months ago. It held that the operation of a UK website that sold into the United States to US customers didn't amount to sufficient presence in the United States to confer jurisdiction for recognition purposes under English rules, even though the website was priced in dollars and it had shipping details to US and Canada. This did not, they said, amount to the type of allegiance to the United States necessary to support recognition. Well, I think on that basis, mere publication of a work in the United Kingdom of itself, or of making a US copyright registration as the basis for class membership in the Google Book settlement, is not going to be regarded as qualitative immigration. Now, you may say, so what? People might find the non-recognition of the settlement a little bit troubling. After all, since the settlement only compromises U.S. claims, the only duplicative suit that might be thrown might actually occur if the settlement were non-recognized would involve a U.S. claim. If a U.S. court were faced with such a complaint, it would enforce the settlement. Now that, of course, assumes that the absent English plaintiff would be silly enough to sue in the United States. What if, relying on case law in the United Kingdom that parallels Boosie and Hawks, the English plaintiff brought an action under U.S. copyright law, but in the U.K. courts? Well, until Lucasfilms, that was actually something that most commentators have for over a decade now thought they could have done because of jurisdictional liberalization in England. But here, the Lucasfilms in their second estate actually helped Google out a little bit. The Court of Appeal went against that prevailing assumption and held that foreign copyright claims should not be justiciable in English courts, absent a treaty on the point. And I should say, they weren't really encouraging a treaty on the point. That was really made more rhetorically, I think. I think the analysis of the Court of Appeal is particularly unpersuasive. For example, they cite in support of the proposition the Federal Circuit opinion in Voda versus Cordes, which of course is a patent case, without making any reference to the Boosie and Hawks opinion in the Seventh Circuit, which is a copyright case. Right. But Lucasfilm's opinion is the latest and highest authority, so maybe it's still not that much of a trouble for Google that it would be non-enforced. Well, that still leaves one other fly in the ointment, and that is independent causes of action under foreign copyright claims. The extent to which such causes of action interfere with the scope of Google's project may depend upon how easily foreign laws will be found applicable to what Google is doing. Google could, of course, as it's done in other areas of its business, simply adopt different business models in different countries, respecting the different policy choices of different countries, notwithstanding the inefficiencies that that causes to Google. But the ability to do that rather than, and this is the other option, comply internationally with the most restrictive national law, depends upon how easily a court in an author-protective country, let's just take France as an obvious example, will localize online conduct as occurring in its territory as opposed to in the United States, and therefore apply the local law. And in France already, Le Martinaire recently successfully sued Google under French law for infringement by virtual scanning that occurred abroad but enabled access in France. So I do think that the private international law doubts are actually still significant enough to take into account. What's the bottom line here to conclude? I think the bottom line is that the majority opinion is that public international copyright law appears to have little to say at the moment about the Google Book settlement, but I suggest I think that is just too facile a conclusion based upon the form of the class action. But the private international copyright law copyright is still too nascent really to offer sufficient certainty to parties regarding the sanctity of the agreement internationally. Now, of course, a project that is both so potentially beneficial and some would argue so potentially harmful as the Google Books project elicits different responses in different countries. International copyright law has always sought to reflect the different values in different countries, and so maybe that's appropriate. So let me finish with an observation that is a little bit more perhaps amateur psychotherapy than real legal analysis about those different values. Unlike many historical battles over the course of the Berne Convention, I'm not so sure this is simply a dispute between droit d'auteur and copyright systems. What divides the countries in the debate and the parties in the debate is not merely, although it may include, theoretical questions about whether formalities are appropriate and consistent with the European conception of copyright or droit d'auteur, or whether, in fact, an opt-in system or not an opt-out system is appropriate. Caricaturing only somewhat, Europe remains a culture where there is a distrust of market power that is far greater than the United States. And the United States is much more skeptical, I suggest, of government intervention. Many in Europe would, I suspect, be quite happy at the Google Books project if it were occurring under government superintendence, and especially non-American government superintendence. European nations have, after all, made efforts to create their own digital library, Europeana. You might not have heard of it. Whether these differences persist, or whether the same differences persist in 25 years is really very hard to tell. the growing interdependence of nations, the greater reliance on digital delivery of products, the homogenization of culture, all suggest that we should be able, if we wish, to reach international solutions more easily. But at present, it may well be that international copyright law, at least as conventionally understood, has very little to say about the Google Book settlement. And that, I think, perhaps sadly, speaks volumes about the importance of our revisiting and broadening our conception of what exactly international copyright law is all about. Thanks. Some questions.
I thought it was an incredibly interesting speech talk, and it seems to me that your conclusions are really supported by what really hasn't happened, which is looking separately at what the lawsuit was initially about, which was the massive copying in Ann Arbor of 4 million books sitting in a particular library. When you focus it on that wrong, the French and Germans have nothing to say, because there's no question but that these books sitting in America are protected by American copyright law and are entitled to remedies. All of the problems arise with the possibility of instantaneous digital distribution. And it's that, for example, that in a lawsuit against Google in England or in Germany or in France, it seems to me the right remedies are to bring lawsuits for infringement. And when Google shows the judgment in the United States and says, well, we have the right to do this, the national courts in those countries will just say, we don't really care about that.
Right. It's a good point, which is that the copying in itself, the online access changes the whole nature of the domain.
That's the problem.
Yeah, and what's interesting about it is, of course, that is what tells you that this, in many ways, is not radically different in some respects from the problems we've seen for 10, 15 years, which is how to localize online content. Which is why private international law has to be something that we develop further to try and resolve these problems. Exactly, can we get some sort of agreement, for example, on applicable law, on whether mere access occasionally by someone who's managed to hack through for 3 proxy servers is sufficient to give the French courts a jurisdiction in particular cases?
When the same novel is getting published in London and New York, by separate publishers with different sets of rights, the amount of violation of rights is small enough so that everybody could live with it. When it's online instantaneously and, you know, the American rights holder is making all the money from everybody in London, that's a problem.
Yeah, although it's interesting, you've commented about the separate national rights being granted. One of the things that's also looking prospectively at how you might see commercial actors change is whether some of the contractual arrangements that are made, obviously, in terms of the business models that are pursued by publishers might change. Depending on the extent to which we really are going to continue to segregate applicable law, or whether you have to deal with this as one global market and start dealing with the distributors and other parts of the business as essentially under a single set of contracts. No one else has anything to say about Google.
I just wanted to ask, how do you spell Europana?
Yeah. How do you spell it? Europe, A-N-A, I think.
Just so I can Google it.
One of the things that's come of being transatlantic is I have lost any capacity to have any confidence in the way I spell a word. So I apologize if I got that wrong. Google European Digital, Google, pardon the pun, pardon the genericization of search. If you Google European Digital Library, you'll get it.
I have one question about how Judge Chin ought to use international law in this context. I guess one is a fact question and one is a should question.
Right.
The first question is, has the U.S. government taken a position, has the executive taken a position on what the effect of this agreement on international law is? And if so, should that be conclusive for him?
Well, in terms of the briefs, their original justice position, I think, had more to say on it. And one of the, because they, I think they took note of the extent to which there were objections by foreign right holders. And one of the responses, one of the changes from the original agreement to the second one, was this contraction of the class and other things as well, including putting certain foreign British, Canadian, Australian right holders in the books registry and potentially being involved in the class settlement negotiations. So there was a change made clearly in response to some of that. Reading the statement of interest by Justice on the amended settlement, they're more interested in a set of other issues, sort of the opt-in, opt-out issue. They're interested on some of the competition issues, I think, still. And it seems that the international issues have been downplayed. That being said, if you read speeches made in particular by the Register of Copyrights outside the briefs, you see a lot more reference to the international concerns. So I'm sure they're having to deal with it. I speculate that they're having to deal with that in discussions with other government officials. So I'm sure it's bubbling up there, but it didn't play as prominent a role in the actual filings. In terms of the should question, I still think it is relevant. Some of the arguments are relevant because clearly this has the capacity, in fact, to create a bunch of knock-on effects, a worldwide model. And I think that the way you will ultimately ensure greater recognition and enforcement of what is, and I say this in parroting the French government, German government briefs, but I don't mean it in quite the same way. But basically, an American private company being in charge of all this material. Which is why I said I think that's the sense you get from reading the briefs. The way that will be accepted a little more readily if you ultimately have to have enforcement in those other countries, if it looks as you have actually tipped your hat in some way and taken account of some of the concerns of those countries when you actually went through the process. It actually reminds me of a brief that was filed in another conflicts case, a patent case involving BlackBerry, when Canada filed an amicus brief. And it's actually one more intelligent amicus brief file, I think, in conflicts cases in IP in a long time, in which they said, look, you know, you understand this wouldn't be a patent infringement in Canada, and you understand we have some different views on this, and we understand that you cannot possibly render a judgment that has no effect in Canada. We're not asking you for that. But what we're asking you for is at least to take into account our views and our interests. When you make your decision, right? On that case, on what essentially was functioning as a choice of law decision. And that's the kind of approach that I think that Judge Chin should be adopting, which is that it is likely to render his decision, and if endorsed on appeal, decisions of the appellate court, more acceptable to other countries, if it looks as though you've at least taken into account their interest in formulating the relief.
How would you deal with orphan books?
Well, that's a broader question, right? You mean actually in a substantive, you want to draft my statute now, or you want me to approve the process of a settlement versus legislation? I think the answer is I prefer to do it through legislation than the class action books. The problem is the Register of Copyrights has some doubts, I think, whether you could have as forward-looking and as generous a system through legislation, because she would worry about the Berne Convention compatibility if you'd enact basically the Google settlement as a piece of legislation. I think this gets back a little bit to some of the formalities point. I think there's two devices that one could use to try and sustain orphan works legislation in compliance with Berne. The one device is to understand that the notion of what formalities are covered by Article 5.2, which we understand, if you do, for example, Ricketts and Ginsburg on this, it's really driven by historical understandings of what was on which side of the line. I would rather, this is much more speculative, I would rather that one of the changes that occurs in WTO decision-making over the next few years is a move towards accepting that what they're doing is really operating almost as a world IP constitutional court. And therefore what they're doing is they're increasingly doing what a number of courts have done at the national level and what courts such as the European Court of Human Rights have done at the regional level, which is basically to assess the motivations for a law and the means used to put a law into effect consistent with the basic purposes of the international system. So to me, the formalities question should not be as the way Ricketts and Ginsburg and others actually analyzed it, which is, you know, is it substantive, is it procedural, et cetera, et cetera. That's relevant. I think that's clearly relevant because you have to implement the treaty commitments that have been made. But increasingly, I'd like to see the WTO asking questions such as, well, what is the purpose of the notice requirement of that, whatever that formality is? is it a formality that is meant to further the purposes of the Berne Convention? It seems to me that greater access to a number of works that would not otherwise be publicly available is consistent, and giving, particularly with respect to out-of-print works, some remuneration to authors who would otherwise get none is consistent with the Berne Convention, and then connecting that purpose to the means chosen. What that nexus is, and you can come up with any number of different constitutional standards, rational relationship, least burdensome, you know, we've got the American equivalent. That's the type of analysis that I would like to see moving to be part, increasingly part of the way that you approach it. If that happened, then the formalities question becomes less significant. Without that happening, I think the way you have to play with it is remedies. Which used to say, essentially, that if someone has made, as indeed the last draft of legislation suggests, that someone has made reasonable efforts, then in fact the relief that is available again by a rights holder against that is limited in particular ways. I think the remedial part of the TRIPS agreement is in fact an area where quite explicitly the drafter said there was going to be a lot left to national autonomy, and so that is where there is already room, but I would also like to see more room injected by much more sort of teleological analysis of the meaning of the concept of formality. So that's a long answer. I would have to, as I say, if you wanted to draft a statute, that would take an even longer amount of time.
Alright. So in closing, thank you once again to Reed Ellsberg and LexisNexis for